Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
Well, this was a terrible disaster yesterday afternoon in Minneapolis, St. Paul, in Minnesota, and our hearts go out to the people of that community. It's extraordinary to see a community pulling together as they are. It's all American. I mean, it's just an all American thing. People pulling together to try to rescue the heroic stories of people showing up from as much as 100 miles away, within, you know, as fast as they could drive there. People who are volunteer firemen or who have EMT credentials or whatever. You know, how can we help? Construction workers showing up. How can we help? Just, you know, Americans pitching in. It's what Americans do so well. And there are many dimensions to this story, and want to discuss a couple of them, and not even specifically the story of what happened in Minneapolis, but it really is meta to a larger story, which is what's going on with our infrastructure and our roads and our bridges across the United States. The Heartland Institute issued a news release yesterday, about 2 hours before the bridge collapsed, in which they said Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, Republican, issued 20 full or partial vetoes of tax hikes and increased spending in May, giving taxpayers reason to smile. Pawlenty, in a move that took everyone by surprise, vetoed an entire $334 million emergency capital investment bill. 2 weeks later, Pawlenty announced another important veto, this one to block a transportation bill containing more than $5 billion in tax and fee increases, and then, you know, goes through the whole list of all the various types of taxes and fees. Congressman Peter DeFazio is with us. Congressman DeFazio of Oregon is on the House Transportation Committee that participates with and oversees much of this kind of stuff. Congressman DeFazio, welcome to the program. I am not able to hear the congressman.
Hello,
Congressman DeFazio. Let's try and put you on a different pot here. Yeah, can you hear us now? No, I'm sorry, Congressman. It's not going to work. We're going to try and put you on a different phone. And while we're doing that, and also we wanted to ask Congressman DeFazio about what's going on with his attempts to find out from the Bush administration what their plans are to run the government in the event of a true disaster. Congressman, let's try it again.
Hello.
No. This is just terribly distorted. Is it sounding okay on your end there, Justin? It's not. Okay. I'm sorry. We've got something wrong with the phone system there in New York, and we're going to have to try and figure out what it is. Carmen we're going to figure out what it is. But in the meantime here, this news release from the Heartland Institute, this is, so bizarre, and that 2 weeks after this May 1st veto of this $334 million emergency capital investment bill, two weeks later, the governor of Minnesota vetoing another $5 billion in tax and fee increases. George Bush talked about this morning, broadly, or maybe I should say obliquely. First of all, he pointed out, he said, we in the federal government must respond and respond robustly to help the people there not only recover, but to make sure that lifeline of activity, the bridge, gets rebuilt as quickly as possible. Well said. And then he goes on to say that he points out that there was an inspection of the bridge a couple of years ago that found structural deficiencies in that particular bridge. And he said, and I am quoting the president now, the president of the United States, he said, if an inspection report identifies deficiencies, the state is responsible for taking corrective actions. This in a federally funded bridge, and there's a grain of truth in that, but there's also, you know, the problem is the states are appropriating funds, and shall we try one more time here for Congressman DeFazio? No, It's still all busted up. There's something wrong, Justin, in the way your board is configured. It's just, yeah, there's something wrong with the way that the audio is going from the Telos into the board. The funds coming from the federal government are available to states, but the states have to appropriate matching funds. And this is where it gets very strange. The Surface Transportation Policy Project, for example, transact.org is the website, pointed out the bridge program providing federal assistance to repair or replace aging bridge infrastructure has identified over 80,000 bridges in the United States. Now, not all of them, in fact, only a minority of them federal bridges. There are, 585,000 federal bridges, and they've identified 80,000 bridges with some sort of specific structural deficiency. 30% of all the 585,000 federal bridges have some sort of structural deficiency. 70% of these bridges, 547 bridges carry 70% of all the traffic in the United States. That's pretty mind-boggling. You know, 70% of all the traffic in the United States at some point travels over 547 bridges. And I think there's it's a reasonable guess that this bridge was probably among those. And so the question or the issue, the larger one, and do we have the congressman back on the line? Justin? No. Okay. Sorry. The question or the issue is, what is being done about this? You know, I very much want to get this phone call in here, so we're going to take a break right now, and we're going to come back and see if we can get the phone problem sorted out at Air America so that we can have a conversation with our guest, and we've got a couple of other guests lined up. We've got to get this solved. It's 12 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio.
Listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 17 minutes past the hour. Here's the issue in my mind, and this isn't specific to what happened in Minneapolis. It's about a larger issue, and that is that we have 80,000 bridges in the United States that have been identified as being structurally deficient. And states, in order to be able to spend federal matching dollars, have to tax their citizens, right? They have to raise the money to match the federal money. And because there has been this hysteria that has been driven by and large by right-wing think tanks funded mostly by very wealthy individuals and family fortunes who are, of course, opposed to anything that resembles a tax. Overall, the states have spent only 73% of the bridge funding allocated by Congress over the last decade. Only about three-quarters of the money that Congress makes available to the states ever gets spent, in large part because the states don't have the matching funds. And when they don't have the matching funds, they can't do the repair work. You can't do the repair work. You got no bridge, you got nothing. We're seeing, and it's not just bridges, we're seeing the infrastructure all across the United States disintegrating, crumbling, and very little is being done about it in the face of this absolute onslaught from conservatives saying, no, you're not going to raise my taxes. Inflation might have gone up 3%, but you're not going to raise the taxes 3%. So what happens is, as inflation goes up and the value of money becomes less and less, this is a way of essentially strangling government. which ultimately is strangling we the people, because government is the instrument, is the institution that maintains the infrastructure of this country. It's the institution that maintains the commons of this country. Government is we the people in the United States. And right across the board, what we're seeing in state after state after state, and again, this the news release from was published in Budget and Tax News. It was released yesterday from the Heartland Institute, which is one of the conservative organizations that aggressively lobbies against any kind of tax increases. In association with the Taxpayers League of Minnesota, another group that is absolutely and totally opposed to any sort of, well, I shouldn't say any sort of, I should let them speak for themselves. And in fact, they were scheduled to be on the program right now speaking for themselves. Hopefully we can get our phone situation fixed and get some of these folks on. But, you know, they're just, you know, right across the board saying no. We don't believe in the, again, not putting words in their mouth, but by and large, the libertarian, Republican, conservative mantra is that they don't believe that we the people collectively should be participating in governance. They don't believe that we the people collectively should be part of the commons, should be running the commons. Let's turn the commons over to private corporations. You got Indiana, for example, having to sell off their highways. Indiana selling off their highways to private corporations. Now, is a private corporation a for-profit institution? In fact, in this case, in the case of Indiana, a for-profit institution in Spain, are they going to buy a state highway, tollway, bridges, roads? Are they going to buy that because they think that they're going to lose money on it? Of course not. So if they think that they're going to make money on it and be able to make a profit that they're going to skim off the top and put in their pockets, why would any state say, hey, wait a minute, we've got an asset here that a corporation can make a profit on. We're going to sell it to them. Why wouldn't the state say, this is our asset? This is something that we're going to build. Well, because the states are denied the ability to protect that asset through tax dollars. They're just, you know, you got these guys coming out. So here we have this news release in the Heartland Institute. Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, Republican, issued 20 full or partial vetoes of tax hikes and spending increases in May, giving taxpayers reason to smile. This was a news release that was issued yesterday. Despite the vetoes, for only the third time in 20 years, the Minnesota legislature will not be meeting in special session during a budget year. Although that alone would be cause to celebrate, the work that was finished on the state's $35 billion biennial budget will allow Minnesotans to rest easy until the legislature reconvenes in February 2008. And then they point out, Minnesota taxpayer advocates had little reason for optimism at the start of the 2007 legislative season, but their spirits rose on April 14th when Twin Cities talk show host Jason Lewis gathered 7,000 people on the steps of the state capitol in St. Paul for one of the largest pro-taxpayer rallies, or you could say anti-government, I suppose, in Minnesota history. Then on May 1st, Pawlenty, in a move that took everyone by surprise, vetoed an entire $334 million emergency, in quotes, capital investment bill. Pawlenty said in his veto message, the bill authorized, quote, more than four times more spending on projects than I requested and is simply too large, end quote. 2 weeks later, Pawlenty announced another important veto, this one to block a transportation bill containing more than $5 billion in tax and fee increases. Now, they're only talking about the tax side of this, including adding another 7.5 cents to the per gallon gasoline tax, a wheelage tax, tax on vehicles, sales tax increases for transit spending, an excise tax on new car purchases, and an increased tab and license fees, with a total cost that the Heartland Institute calculates would be to the average Minnesota family of up to $500 a year. Yeah, of up to. That's what, if you own five Hummers? Anyhow, Pawlenty ended the month of May vetoing tax bills approved by the Democratic Farmer Labor Party, the DFL, which controls the legislature in Minnesota, which last November regained the majority in the House for the first time since 1998 by picking up 19 seats and expanding their majority in the Senate to a nearly veto-proof 44-23. And they go on to say the transportation bill The irony of this news release going out yesterday morning is just so boggling. The transportation bill is the only one that the DFL tried to override. The attempt came with less than 20 minutes remaining in the session and was defeated by House Republicans, led by that noble minority leader. I inserted that noble. By minority leader Marty Seifert, the Republican from Marshall, Minnesota. Democrats made too many campaign promises to win their seats and are now learning they can't pay for them, he said after the failed override attempt. Ultimately, it was DFL's inability to override any of Pawlenty's vetoes, particularly the transportation bill, that resulted in a comparatively small $3 billion increase in state spending with no new taxes. And then the president of the Taxpayers League of Minnesota, Mr. Crinkle, says Minnesotans really need to thank Governor Pawlenty and Republican Representative Seifert's House Republicans. These guys stood strong in the face of overwhelming pressure and came through for taxpayers when they really needed them. Yeah. And George Bush, in the meantime, saying, if an inspection report identifies deficiencies, the state is responsible for taking corrective actions. Sort of like, you know, if there's a hurricane and it whacks New Orleans, the state is responsible. It's like on Drudge, you know, showing the picture of the yellow school buses for 4 days in a row, never pointing out the fact, as was testified by the governor, Kathleen Blanco, the fact that FEMA had specifically told New Orleans not to use those buses because they were bringing in their own buses. So break government and then say, oh, look, government doesn't work. Now, again, none of this is specific to what's going on in Minnesota. I mean, there is a very, very difficult time for the people in the Twin Cities, and our hearts and prayers go out to them, and we wish them the very best. And yesterday afternoon as I was driving home, I flipped on the radio to Michael Savage, and here he is going, there's Muslims behind this. Say, what? Or at least his callers were. He was kind of egging them on. And right after 9/11, you know, look at the opportunity that was seized by the Republicans. Or right after Katrina, you had right-wing talk show hosts, Limbaugh and company going along saying, well, this is because of the welfare mentality. These people aren't smart enough to get in out of the rain. I mean, it's extraordinary. And it's going to be interesting to see how they try to spin this one. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
34 minutes past the hour. Let's try this one more time. Congressman Peter DeFazio, are you there?
I hope so, Tom.
Ah, you are! Eureka!
Sometimes the magic works, sometimes it doesn't. The wonders of deregulation.
Indeed. And our engineering staff at Air America. I'm curious, before we get into your experiences on the Transportation Committee and how this all works between states and federal government, which is the main topic that I wanted to bring up with you, but I'm curious to follow up on our conversation of last week when you had asked the Bush administration to, in the super secret environment, highly secure, you with all your classified, you know, et cetera, because you're on the Homeland Security Committee, if they would simply share with you their plans for running this country after, God forbid, another terrorist attack, and they said no. Has there been any follow-up on that?
Yeah, we received a response to the written request of the chairman of the committee, chairman of the subcommittee, and myself from Francis Townsend, the president's national security advisor, saying no, we can't see it. Members of Congress are not allowed to know about how we might continue government after a terrorist attack, and they they say, and we're checking up on this, that they have, quote, briefed leadership staff or leadership or whatever, but we're checking with the speaker and the majority leader. To this point, we're not aware that anybody has had any meaningful review. They may have been briefed on the meaningless public document that the Bush administration released that they say is unprecedented. They gave so much information. If you read it, it's like something on the back of a cereal box. I mean, you know, I mean, I would flunk a graduate student or even an undergraduate who said this is what this would be my plan to run the government after a terrorist attack. I'd say there's nothing there. So either they don't have a plan, you know, it's like Katrina, and they're covering that up, or they have a plan that has elements that might be of dubious constitutionality, or it's just their obsessive, compulsive, secretive nature, one of those three things.
But the bottom line, ultimately, is that the Bush administration does have a plan for running this country after a terrorist attack, and they are refusing to tell Congress what role they're going to give Congress if, and this is not a terrorist attack that would, you know, destroy the infrastructure of America. We're talking about just another 9/11, for example.
Yeah, no, I mean, they say they have one, and they say it has classified detailed annexes, and we're not allowed to see them. Congress is not allowed to review it. So, you know,
isn't
that
illegal?
Well, we're looking at our options here. It seems extraordinary to me since we are, you know, theoretically a co-equal constitutionally authorized branch of government, and there would be, you know, some desire to continue, well, at least on the part of some folks, to continue a Congress. And have Congress involved after an attack, but perhaps the administration's view is different.
Incredible. I can't tell you how many people have emailed me about this, suggesting that they're of the opinion that this is part of some grand scheme to, you know, shut down the country or stop the elections in 2008 from happening if it looks like it's going to be a bloodbath for the Republicans kind of thing. Do you think that there's anything to these conspiracy theories, or is do you think this is just the Bush administration being the Bush administration? Although
I mean, I think it could be one of the three. As I said, I mean, it could be they have got something that's unconstitutional, extra constitutional in their plan, or it could be that they just don't have a plan. It's their usual incompetence. Or it's just their, you know, Dick Cheney's, you know, obsessive, compulsive, secretive nature. But I don't see how the people of America benefit from not sharing the plan with fully cleared and vetted members of the Homeland Security Committee, who, you know, obviously will play a role in this in terms of the Department of Homeland Security and FEMA, who would play a critical role.
Well, maybe, unless their plan is to say, you know, George is now the emperor.
Yeah. So, no, we're going to keep pushing. I'm going to talk to Chairman Thompson today and figure out. Well, first, we're checking to see if there's been any meaningful discussion with the speaker or the majority leader, which I doubt. And then we can essentially go back and say they're lying, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, interesting. We're talking with Congressman Peter DeFazio. He's on the Homeland Security Committee. He's also on the Transportation Committee. Congressman, these reports that are out indicating that there are, let me find my statistics here.
Number right here. We have 75,621 deficient bridges in America.
Wow. Okay. And 73% of the funding that you guys have actually allocated at the federal level is only 73% is spent by states. In many cases, I understand, because states are not able to raise the matching funds because they've got conservative groups out there fighting against so-called tax increases.
Sure, good old Dick Armey. He may have left Congress, but his group has been meddling in my state and other states anti-tax for the sake of being anti-tax. I mean, look, I mean, the way they figure it is, the rich people aren't going to use these roads. They'll take the helicopter to the jet port and get on their private jet and fly to their private resort. And the kids will go to private schools and, you know, they'll go to private hospitals. I mean, what do we need public infrastructure for? So, I mean, you know, this right-wing, extreme right-wing group has been resisting, and they have cowed many more reasonable Republicans and conservatives into and sticking with them. I mean, you know, Bush started out when I'm the chairman of the Service Transportation Subcommittee. We have jurisdiction over this issue. In the last highway bill 2 years ago, when I was in the minority, the Bush administration said they needed Bush's Department of Transportation. We should spend $375 billion over 5 years to deal with problems like structurally deficient bridges and dangerous outmoded interchanges and things like that, in addition to just regular maintenance and dealing with congestion. $375 billion is what they said we needed. Bush said $250, not a penny more. And ultimately, after a two-year dispute with the Congress, we drug him kicking and screaming up to $283 billion, all paid for out of the trust fund, out of gas taxes, no borrowing or deficit there. And then he, of course, claimed credit for it. But it's way below the number his own department says they needed, and the American Society of Civil Engineers says that number is way low. We're talking more like $500 billion over 5 years. So we are way underinvesting and underspending in our infrastructure. This is becoming absolutely critical. Now people are losing their lives. We're not just losing our daily lives in terms of being stuck in traffic, having to be rerouted around weight-limited bridges, having congestion and pollution and all those other things because we're underinvesting. Now people are dying. Hopefully this will be a turning point in this debate, and we'll be able to discuss reasonable ways to raise money to make more needed investments.
Yeah. As chairman of the Surface Transportation Subcommittee, the organization, the House of Representatives, Congressman DeFazio, that has oversight for how federal monies are spent on bridges and things, what's the biggest problem in driving money into the states so that federally funded bridges can actually get, and other roadways and other infrastructure can get repaired?
Well, first off, there isn't enough money in the aggregate, and then some states have set different priorities. We do give them some flexibility to determine where their greatest needs are, and so they can move some money between programs. But I think what this shows is that perhaps we need to narrow down that flexibility a little bit and make certain that they're putting more money into programs like bridges, deficient bridges, and some of the other things will either have to wait or they'll have to raise a little more money on their own as a state. And in this state, you have a super anti-tax Republican who just vetoed a couple of bills to invest in infrastructure. I mean, he's like a mini-me George Bush, you know? I mean, I think maybe he's going to come to regret those vetoes.
Yeah, Governor Tim Pawlenty, the Republican in Minnesota. This and I find it so ironic that yesterday, about 3 hours before the bridge collapsed, the Heartland Institute and the Taxpayers League of Minnesota issued this news release saying very proudly that Pawlenty announced another important veto, this one to block a transportation bill containing more than $5 billion in tax
increases. They will lock them.
Say that again?
Just blacked
Are you still
out.
There, Congressman?
Done.
Congressman DeFazio? We have lost Congressman DeFazio.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate the opportunity for almost completing the interview.
Congressman, we can still hear you. And so, okay. You might want to thank him and drop him there, Justin, because the board seems to have croaked again. So 44 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. We're going to take a break here, and we'll be back right after this break with more about what's going on, not just in Minnesota, but all over the country. This problem of the tragic, frankly, underfunding. I mean, we've got almost 80,000 bridges in the United States that have already been determined to be deficient. And yet there are all kinds of groups out there organized, aggressively organized, to prevent any funding from going to that. 44 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Well, I left Kentucky back in 49 and went to Detroit working on assembly line. The first year they had me putting wheels on Cadillac. Every day I'd watch them beauties roll by, and sometimes I'd hang my head and cry, 'cause I always wanted me one that was long and black. One day I devised myself a plan that should be the envy of most any man. I'd sneak it out of there in a lunchbox in my hand. Now getting caught meant getting fired, but I figured I'd have it all by the time I retired. I'd have me a car worth at least $100,000.
Yeah.
I
plan on.
One piece at a time. And
one piece at a time. Well, I suppose that's how taxes work. Steve Stanek is with us. He's the managing editor for Budget and Tax News, a newspaper sent to every elected official. He also is with the Heartland Institute, heartland.org. Steve, welcome to the program. Steve? I got no Steve, Justin.
Yes. Hello?
Steve? Yeah.
Yes.
Hey, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. Hi.
Okay. Sorry, we're having some, we've got a fill-in board op and some phone problems.
You have my sympathies. It's amazing. Anytime I get involved with anything of a technical nature, so there's a glitch.
So you're the guy who did this. Well, actually,
if it's beyond clay tablet and chisel, I have trouble with it. So
yeah, I understand. I can empathize. Yesterday, the Heartland Institute, the group that you work with, issued this news release basically talking about how wonderful it was that the Republican governor, Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota, vetoed $5 billion in transportation taxes. Which
I haven't seen the press release, to be honest with you, but I know we had an article in our Budget and Tax News publication on that.
Right. In fact, that's where it was published, apparently, according to the news release. And I'm just curious, we have almost 80,000 bridges in the United States that have been declared in trouble, that are structurally deficient. That's the efficient
well,
term.
That's, yeah, I was listening on CNN this morning, as a matter of fact. I heard the governor and the mayor and a couple of, I think there were structural engineers talking about that.
Right. And so how can you justify aggressively lobbying Republicans in various state legislatures and governors, in this case in Minnesota, to veto spending for infrastructure when our infrastructure in this country has been crumbling ever since the 1980s?
Well, first of all, Heartland does not lobby. I don't lobby. No one at Heartland lobbies.
I don't mean legally
lobby. We merely report after the fact that the governor vetoed this.
Right. But you report it in a way that is laudatory, right?
Yeah, we believe that spending ought to be done responsibly. Now, as for the bridges, according to what I heard these engineers and the governor himself say this morning, they had no reports that that bridge was structurally unsound.
Actually,
and
the way he defined this
with these thousands of bridges, it means, he said, it needs to be watched, need to be maintained. And we're not against, I'm not against infrastructure spending if it is spent wisely. I'll tell you, I'm 52 years old. I've lived my entire life in Illinois. This is a state where four of our last six governors have gone to federal prison. Our immediate past governor is supposed to be in prison right now, but he's out on appeal. He was convicted on all 18 counts of a federal felony indictment on a whole host of things, including
rigging
of contracts.
Sounds like the system is working.
So, I mean, there's you need to ask, what is the money being spent on, and how is it being spent? Simply saying that we're going to spend big gobs of money on infrastructure does not mean that you're actually spending big gobs of money on things that are going to do any good.
No, but the point is that you guys are basically opposed to pretty much any taxes. I mean,
absolutely untrue.
Okay, well, here's the question then. Here's a larger question then. What is the appropriate role of government in this? Illinois has privatized some of its roads. Indiana just privatized one of their roads. Do you think that that's the direction that we should be going in the United States, that more and more of these public infrastructure projects should simply be handed over to private for-profit corporations?
I don't know that I would characterize it as just handing it over to them. These are lease agreements that have a lot of restrictions on them. Privately spent money, I think, is better in certain circumstances. As for roads and bridges and that kind of thing, I just came across the Chicago Skyway last week, and you can tell that it's been improved since it was taken over privately. Many roads and airports in Europe are privately funded and owned. I think a lot of people in the United States would be surprised at the extent to which you have privately owned and operated airports and roads and bridges.
No, I agree. I think a lot of Americans would be surprised, both in Europe and in the United States. And here's my concern. You have, for example, in Indiana now, you've got a Spanish company extracting the profits from Indiana and taking it back to Spain, first of all. But secondly, just a for-profit who now has an interest in making sure that more and more people are using the roads, which means that they will be working against any sort of investments in, for example, public transportation, against light rail, against, you know, any sort of anything that's going to siphon traffic off, against carpooling, you know, just broadly against public transportation.
Well,
why would we
ridiculous.
Take...
I mean, that,
no,
we have roads
ridiculous.
That are so congested now, they can hardly handle anything. And so
somebody's going to make a profit off it.
Well,
and
what's wrong with that? Does Air America want to make a profit?
No, obviously Air America wants to make a profit. Air America doesn't control the infrastructure of America's roads. We're talking about the stuff that is absolutely necessary to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We're talking about the stuff that's necessary to get to work. You don't need Air America to get to work. You need a road to get to work.
What does it matter if $1 billion is spent by private investors or $1 billion is spent by public investors if the objective is obtained?
Because if it's spent by public investors, 10, 15, 20% isn't being skimmed off the top to pay as dividends to stockholders, to pay as multi-million or billion dollars.
I would say 10, 20% is being skimmed off in no-bid contracts and in rigged contracts and in
then let's
political
go after
favors.
Those.
I mean, look at the new
let's
bridge
go after
nowhere
those.
In Alaska.
That let's go after those. Ted Stevens should pay
owned,
for
owned on property by the Murkowski family to help make them wealthy.
I absolutely agree. You have some very corrupt Republicans in Alaska. Several, in fact, the entire congressional delegation, their member of Congress, Don Young, and both of their senators are all under investigation right now.
Look, I mean, fundamentally, you're asking, you asked, what is the role of government?
No.
Well, you did just a minute ago, right?
Yeah. And arguably, sure.
I think we have different perspectives on this, but I would say the role of government should be to advance liberty. It should be to protect the public welfare, safety.
How can you
sort of
have
thing.
Liberty if you can't rely on your infrastructure?
Well, I would agree with that, and
that's why you want
I don't object to the federal government or state governments building roads and bridges and things. I don't object to private entities building roads and bridges if they think they can do it. I mean, there's
Steve, we're
right
out of time
now,
here. But you made your point well, and I appreciate your coming on. Steve Stanek, heartland.org, the website.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Well, it seems that our topic for the day is the knee-jerk reaction against taxes. Whatever happened to the idea that taxes are the price you pay for membership in a civil society? I mean, there was a time in the United States when there was actually a broad public consensus in favor of establishing and raising taxes. In fact, arguably for at least three quarters of the history of this country. Dan Gaynor is with us. He is with the Business and Media Institute, businessandmedia.org, the website, a conservative think tank that suggests taxes are not always a great thing. Dan, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be back, Tom. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. I hope you're well, too.
I am indeed.
This piece that Julia Seymour wrote over at the Business and Media Institute, death and taxes may be the only certainty in life. Journalist support for higher taxes is almost predictable. And you guys go off on this thing about sin taxes, taxes on alcohol, tobacco, and unhealthy foods and environmentally unfriendly actions. First of all, you know, let me just toss it to you. How can you oppose a tax on tobacco or on alcohol or for that matter on things that cause pollution that kill our children?
That I knew the children thing would have to come up in there somewhere.
There you go.
What you're talking about are in many cases tr- truly outlandish taxes designed to control people's activity when, you know, the marketplace controls people's activity.
Wait a second, Dan. They're designed to influence people's activity,
no.
And the marketplace doesn't control behavior.
When,
I don't think either one of us want the marketplace or anybody else to be controlling behavior.
One of the taxes could increase the tax on cigars from less than 5 cents up to $10 a cigar. That's no
right.
longer that the power to tax truly is. And I mean, I've seen this on left-wing websites as well. Truly is the power to destroy. If you don't like something, you can tax it to death. And that's what these many of these bills are intended to do. They're intended to control our behavior by making the taxes so onerous that we can't pay them. And the media are lining up. It's like this, the S-CHIP, the State Children's Health Insurance Program bill. That's what they're trying
right.
to fund. They say we're trying to fund the children, but meanwhile they're hiding it as what they're hiding is a major tax bill.
So I assume that you are equally opposed, since you're opposed to using tax policy to influence people's behavior, that you're equally opposed to the income tax deductibility for mortgages, and that you're opposed to states or cities or municipalities giving tax breaks to corporations if they'll move into those communities and build factories?
Well, I mean, if you want to get into particulars about the tax code, I think we should blow up the tax code and start over with either a fair or a flat tax. And either one of those would be better than what we have right now. Because what we do have is a whole situation where everybody's got a deduction. You and I could earn exactly the same amount of money, have exactly the same lives, and pay totally different taxes. That's
depending
totally
on how
fair.
We behave. And what we've been doing from the very beginning of taxation in this country is using taxes as a way to influence the behavior that to get people to do more of the behavior that we collectively agree is good for society and do less of the behavior that's bad for society. If people smoking cigars and cigarettes is causing cancer and we, the people, are having to pay the tab for that cancer, and you and I both know that we do to a large extent, then shouldn't we say we're going to recover some of that money or we're going to... And at the same time, we're going to discourage you from engaging in a behavior that is going to cause you to die and cause us to have to pay for it.
Look at the fat taxes. By every study that's out there, including one of the ones we cite in our story, the vast majority of Americans don't support them. We're still getting them. We're still getting snack taxes, sugar taxes, soda taxes, all these taxes we don't support because we don't want people telling us what to eat, but they're still being rammed down our throats. Because
obesity is a major public health problem in the United States. Diabetes is a disaster in the United States. I think it's 1 in 3 adults now is going to experience type 3 diabetes at some point in their life. I mean, and you never answered my question about tobacco. I would submit to you that in both cases, what you have here are behaviors that we want to discourage. And one of the powers that government has, and it seems to me like a good and desirable thing, is to discourage behavior by taxing it and to encourage behavior that's desirable for society by reducing the tax on it.
$10 tax per cigar? That's so outlandish almost be criminal. I hate smoking. I hate being around smoking. I don't smoke. But it is a legal product. It is something a lot of people like to do in this country. And to tax them that badly, have the media just line up and say, we support all these crazy taxes, is just wrong. That's not balanced by any...
Dan, you're going from the macro to the micro, and I'm trying to keep it on the macro. As you know, the $10 per cigar tax does not apply to all cigars.
It could apply to only one brand, one type. Right? So
one brand, one type imported from one country. I mean, the point is that what's wrong with government having tax policies that encourage behavior that's good for society and discourage behavior that's bad for society? Don't we live in a collective, in a society here where we're collectively all in this together?
We live in a society where we're all in it together, but we all are our own people, and we all do get to make our own choices. And when government
but we're not our own
trying,
people.
When government starts trying to control the marketplace by making just a parade of laws, you end up with this. We have
no. But wait a minute. Come on, Dan. Are you suggesting that the water that you drank this morning, you dug from a well yourself? Are you suggesting that the food you ate, you grew yourself? Are you suggesting that the car you drove, you built yourself? Are you suggesting that the roads you drove it on, you built yourself? Are you suggesting that the education that's allowing you to have a cogent conversation with me, you gave to yourself? We're not in this alone.
I didn't say we were all in it collectively, but we all get to make our own individual choices. And that's what this is attempting to take away by mandating government policy.
It's not taking away the choices, it's influencing the choices. Come on, you have to agree with that.
$10 a cigar or a 150% 6% tax on cigarettes, that's not just influencing policy. The people who get hurt the most by that are actually the poor, people I would ordinarily think you would be standing up for.
So you want the poor to be able to cheaply smoke cigars and cigarettes.
No, I want the poor to have the right to make their own decisions. We shouldn't live in a society where they get abused simply by some ridiculous tax.
So it seems to me, Dan, and I mean, let's just thoughtfully consider this for a minute. It seems to me that the fundamental difference between your worldview and mine, the one that we're really arguing about, even, you know, when it gets down to the $10 cigar or whatever, but nonetheless, what we're really arguing about is your belief that a high ideal in American society is the ability of an individual to make any kind of choice that they want, absolutely independent of society as a whole, which is represented by government, trying to influence that behavior. And what I'm suggesting is that we collectively as a society decide what are the behaviors we want to encourage, the behaviors we want to discourage, and frankly, the behaviors we want to punish. I mean, you know, there are laws against doing some things.
Well, no, actually, you're trying to paint me into the libertarian position. I mean, that would defy, you know, pretty much traditional conservative values. We do, you know, conservatives do believe in standing up for country, serving in the military, doing a lot of things. I mean, free market doesn't deliver the best military. You know, we provide the society might deliver the best military, but I do prefer to have government functions perform certain things. But what you're pushing for and what a lot of these journalists and a lot of the, you know, left-wing think tanks are pushing for is just a network of massive government control. And I don't want
influence.
I mean, what's that expression? Government is best which governs least, not which governs not at all. We don't want government.
Well, tell that to the people in New Orleans. But the bottom line here, if we agree that smoking is a public ill and that it's harming all of us and it's costing all of us money and you want to discourage it, if you're not going to use tax policy, what are you going to do? Put people in jail when they smoke?
That's the route you're heading, not me. So you say that we should
agree that it's a public ill and it's a destructive thing to society and we should do absolutely nothing about it.
Well, I mean, we actually discourage it because you can't smoke in a lot of public venues now already because that impacts other people. But when you're talking about impacting yourself, you can make it so difficult on a person that what you're doing, you're encouraging people to flout the law. You're going to encourage people to buy cigarettes in other places and sneak them across the border. You're basically heading down the route of prohibition, which we thought.
Right. You're making an argument for the decriminalization of pot, you realize.
No. I'm simply saying that you can overtax something that is a legal substance to the point where you're encouraging people to not obey the law. Not a good thing.
But we're not even close to this. And what we're talking about here is the principle, not the specific application.
Well, I mean, $10, you know, again, $10 a cigar, or I don't even know what cigarettes go for anymore because I don't have to buy them. But you know, you can get to the point where if ordinary people can't afford a substance, what you're doing is saying it's,
then they're less likely to use it,
or more likely to steal it, or you know, if they really want it, more likely to get it in a way that you and I aren't going to like them doing.
So we should just throw the doors open and say, okay, we give up. We're not going to try and do any what you would call social engineering.
Well,
we're not going to try and influence society in any way.
Stick. What happened to carrots?
Well, the carrot is that if you don't smoke, you have more money.
That's not the carrot. If somebody wants to smoke, they've already made that choice. They've already made that choice in their mind that they want to smoke.
An interesting conversation. Dan Gaynor, he's the director of the Business and Media Institute, businessandandmedia.org. Dan, thanks for sticking with me on this conversation.
Always happy to talk to you soon, Tom.
Okay, thank you. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you on Air America Radio.
Exposing the con in conservative, this is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Well, I know what's right. I got just one life. in a world that keeps on pushing me around. But I stand my ground, and I won't back down.
So, again, to take this out to the larger picture, let's look at what the White House is doing with Hurricane Katrina. And by the way, my apologies to those of you trying to call into the program today. The phones are tot, as they say in German, dead. And so we, at the moment, cannot put callers on the air and for this program right now. They're working on it, as they say. The federal funds for rebuilding after Katrina, the Gulf Coast Fund, this is, you know, your tax dollars that have gone to our tax dollars collectively that have been appropriated by Congress, that the Bush administration, the Republicans administration has said, okay, we're going to spend this money to help rebuild Katrina, help rebuild the Gulf Coast from Katrina. You would think, in a world that makes a lot of sense, you would think that the majority of that money would be going to local businesses. I mean, this is how the Marshall Plan worked in Europe. Give the money to the local companies to rebuild their local areas. Give it give money to Germany to rebuild Germany. Give money to France to rebuild France. Give money to individual states within those countries to rebuild their. And what happens is, in the process of rebuilding, you are also growing those local businesses. Because everybody understood when they did the Marshall Plan that if they paid a Russian company or an Italian company to come in and rebuild Germany, you'd end up with a rebuilt Germany and a very robust Italian company or a Russian company. But the goal was to have Germany be self-sufficient. And so they gave the money to Germany to rebuild Germany. And sure enough, after the companies that built the highway, rebuilt the highways and rebuilt the city structures and rebuilt the infrastructures, those same companies that rebuilt all that stuff ended up being rebuilt themselves by virtue of the fact that the money was given to them and it worked. So it just, I mean, you would look at this, you would think that any reasonable and rational person, particularly a president who claims to have a degree from Yale in history, although there are some questions about who took all those tests for him, but nonetheless, and who wrote his papers, you would think that common sense would dictate that most of the money to rebuild New Orleans was most of the money to rebuild the Gulf Coast, most of the money to rebuild the coast of Mississippi and Louisiana would be going to companies in Mississippi and Louisiana, that it would be going to local companies, because when you're done spending that money, you then not only have new infrastructure and new buildings and new construction and everything, but you also have strong local companies that have hired local people, and those local people are spending money in the local economy, which creates demand for other local businesses. Whereas if you have some big out-of-state corporation coming in and doing it with out-of-state work, or even in some cases out-of-country workforce, they come in, they do the rebuilding, and they leave, and there's, you know, the economic infrastructure doesn't exist, right? This would just be common sense. You would think that if you're going to rebuild the Gulf Coast, you're going to use local companies inside Louisiana, inside New Orleans, inside Mississippi to rebuild Louisiana, Mississippi, New Orleans, that you would think it's just common sense. In the last year, the percentage of federal funds going for Katrina contracts to local contractors, to small Gulf Coast businesses, according to a new analysis by Congress, has declined from 12.5%. Now, this isn't even in the last year. This is just since April. It was at 12.5%. Now, that's abysmal to begin with. It's declined down to 7.4%. 7.5% of our federal dollars that are rebuilding that area down there, which means that, what, 93% and change or 92% and change is going to massive out-of-state corporations, to the Bechtels and Halliburtons of the world. Since April, only 6% of new, this is from this new congressional inquiry. Since April, only 6% of new GSA contracts for Katrina work out of almost $1 million, only $61,000 went to local businesses. The Veterans Administration, they're rebuilding the Veterans Administration. You'd think, wow, rebuilding the Veterans Administration. Let's get some local contractors in here to help rebuild these buildings that were damaged. We have a $3.6 million budget. How much of that $3.6 million was spent with local contractors? $25,000. The rest of it, the other 3.5 and change million, went to big out-of-state corporations. Of the $95.6 million in total contracts that were inaccurately claimed as going to small businesses, more than $77 million, or 81%, were awards by the Defense Department, by the way. 27 minutes past that.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Ron Breinhart of RawStory.com is on the line with us. Our best of the rest of the news segment for the day. RawStory.com, one of the fine news sites out there on the left side of the news, I'd say. Hey, Ron, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot for having me again. Hopefully, I won't get cut off by the phone company again.
Is that what happened last week? The phone company stepped on it?
Yeah, and I was going to call them back and complain, but you know what happened to Kennedy, so.
That's yeah, there you go. Okay. What are you seeing, Ron, as the biggest stories that are floating by you guys over at RawStory.com right now?
Well, right now, today is an absolute insane day. We're posting right now as I speak. I just got done teasing and putting up two other stories right now. There's like so much breaking left and right, it seems. Like right now, the hottest news, yes, is in regards to the Tillman probe. White House officials have agreed to be interviewed off the record. The Waxman just sent out a letter about that. And he's going to do no transcript interviews with them. So that's just coming out right now.
So the White House has said that they'll no transcript interview is one where essentially they can lie and then later deny it because there's no record of it. Is that
true?
Right?
But I see lots of people lying all the time when they are on transcript and interviewed. So I'm not.
Yeah.
Does it really even make much of a difference now?
Yeah. It, increasingly, it's. I guess the skepticism is no longer an oddity. It's yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I understand definitely. I mean, the preference, you definitely want them on the record. Or at the very least, a transcript, doesn't seem like an unreasonable request if you don't want it televised or public, just a transcript. So for Congress, sake of Congress, I guess. But I guess they worry about leaks, the White House, when they make those insane deals or whatever. But, I mean, I don't know. I mean, has there ever been a situation where there was an off-the-record conversation with congressmen and a White House person said, I didn't say that?
I don't know the history of these things, to what extent this has been used in the past. I know that, you know, there's a long history of Congress having, you know, private sessions of the executive branch, but you know, as part of a formal congressional inquiry, I don't know, I think for a lot of Americans, I suspect that the Tillman thing, because we so worship celebrity in the United States, because celebrity is, you know, I mean, if here you've got, you know, Lindsay Lohan at the top of the news, right? Who? I don't think I've ever even seen her in a movie. I mean, because Pat Tillman is a celebrity, it seems that his death is not inappropriately being elevated, but that what's happening is it's punching through the veil of, oh, that's just politics, and getting to the average American, whereas the death of a non-celebrity, you know, we had a woman here in Oregon, for example, whose son was killed in Iraq by the Iraqis that he was training. And this actually is not all that uncommon. It happens with some terrible regularity that Iraqis that are being trained by American troops then turn their guns on the American troops at some point. And the government Department of Defense initially lied to her. We had her on the program and talked about this maybe 6-8 months ago, and told her that he was killed by, you know, in a firefight with the enemy, in quotes or whatever. And in fact, it was in a training. You know, it was not. And that story did not reach the high profile because her son was not Pat Tillman. You know, was not some famous guy. So it seems that the Pat Tillman story has the potential to, or it may already even be punching through that kind of fog that most Americans have about anything that has to do with this, where they kind of put it in the category of, oh, that's just politics, or, oh, that's just the Iraq war. Oh, no, that's a celebrity. Now, wait a minute. We pay attention to that. And therefore has a lot of potential to do damage to the Bush administration in terms of their perceived veracity. Would you agree?
I mean, I guess to a certain extent, but at the same time, what exactly is it going to do? I mean, honestly, it's a horrible, tragic thing, but this isn't going to end the war.
Well, here's the thing. The Congress keeps rolling over with regard to the Bush administration. And even though George Bush's, you know, ratings are in the toilet, I mean, in the 30s, nonetheless, there's this perception in the House and in the Senate among many of the Democrats that George W. Bush still wields a lot of power and that he still has a lot of the American people with him. And so the extent to which stories like this reveal the not just incompetence, but in some cases, you know, outright lies of the Bush administration, I'm of the opinion that it erodes their power because it erodes their credibility. And that might work to the benefit of all of us in as much as it could allow the Democrats to actually do the will of the people and end the war.
Right. I mean, I don't know. I'm not quite twisting logic here.
Yeah.
To me, the way to end the war is to reach common ground with the Republicans that want to pull out. And I don't see enough of that. I mean, I see Murtha now sort of like backing away from the from a few things. If that's true, then maybe a consensus can be reached on that respect. I mean, I'm speaking to someone who was completely against this war to begin with, but I'm just speaking realistically in terms of ending it, yelling things and investigations, and it doesn't matter even if the entire country is behind it. I think a stronger consensus really has to be made between the two parties for that to happen.
But the two parties are supposed to be representing us. I mean, we don't elect leaders in this country. We don't elect kings. We elect representatives. And so if the majority of the country is saying, get out of Iraq, they should be getting out of Iraq, should they not?
I mean, that's kind of, I'm not sure that I would want to say that either, because you wouldn't want to have opinion polls based on whether or not president should, you know,
intercede
in other places.
That,
I mean, for instance, I was in favor of doing something about Sarajevo during, you know, years back, and the polls were definitely against that.
Yeah. At a certain level, you do want the president, you want Congress to do what is right and what they perceive is right, and certainly not be just, you know, putting a finger to the wind all the time and saying, oh, what's happening? But at the same time, they are elected to represent us, and I guess the balance that they have to the equation, the calculus that elected representatives have to do is what the people want versus whether the people will punish that elected official come election time, which is every 2 years for every member of the House of Representatives. And now we have a presidential election coming. Ron, we're talking with Ron Breinert. He is the executive editor at Raw Story, rawstory.com. Ron, what are the stories that you see coming across your desk that you think are going to become the large stories as time goes on?
As time goes on. Well, one, we just broke a story today. Larissa Alexandrovna, one of our reporters, I believe she's been on your show before a few times.
Several times, yes.
Yes. Well, she has a big story today about how the U.S. has been covertly arming Gulf states since 2004, like Saudi Arabia, and that's been in the press a lot lately. The fact that this deal that they've supposedly proposed about arming, you know, sending money to
$20 billion to
Saudi Arabia.
And
in Larissa's article, she found out that it's basically it's already a done deal. It's already a done deal, and that other countries also have been covertly armed over the last number of years. So, I mean, I'm not sure that her article is going to break through the mainstream media, but I would imagine that there's still going to be more on this, more, because a lot of people on both parties, Republicans and Democrats, are very distrustful of Saudi Arabia, and arming them does worry a lot of people. And also you have the ties with the Bush administration and everything a lot for.
How did the Bush administration accomplish arming Gulf states that we may, you know, look at with a bit of a jaundiced eye in some regards? How did they do that without congressional approval, without it already being, you know, pre-approved by Congress?
They have a lot of lawyers. I don't know. They do whatever they want, and they use legalese and twist things around, and, you know, there's no threat against them to do anything. I mean, me personally, what I don't understand more than anything else is signing statements to me is the safest probe investigation or to pursue. I mean, signing statements. There's no Republican in Congress that is happy with the fact that Bush with the pen could change something that was passed in Congress. And allowing Bush to do something all the time. I mean, other presidents did this maybe like once or twice before during their administrations. And Bush does it all the time. And to things that we may never know what he's done. That, to me, is something that should be pursued with a lot more gusto. And it's something that could reach a lot more common ground from the other side and might actually go somewhere. And, again, getting back to even to Walter Reed. So I wonder why, like, on some scandals are picked to go to run all the way with, whereas other ones are better.
Right. Yeah. It's a tough one. It's one that a lot of people are scratching their heads about. And you know, this power, the signing statement power that Sam Alito came up with during the Reagan administration, he was the inventor, essentially, of it. You know, it's a very destructive thing. Ron Breinert, rawstory.com. Thanks, Ron, for being with us.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Mark Carlin on the line with us. He's the editor and publisher of BuzzFlash.com and another great progressive website, news site. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Tom. How are you?
I am fine, just fine. I noticed at the top of BuzzFlash it says, BuzzFlash hasn't cited Bill O'Reilly with a loofah and a young lovely yet at the Coase Convention in Chicago. Is that where you are, at the Coase Convention?
Yes, we are, and we're on a Bill O'Reilly watch, but he must be in his hotel room ridding his site of hate mail against Hillary Clinton because he's nowhere to be seen around him, nor is the young woman who received, have been told, a large settlement from Mr. O'Reilly in a sexual harassment case against him.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We had Mike Stark on the program a couple days ago, the guy who staked out O'Reilly's house and pamphleted his neighbors. And I just felt that going the personal attack route against Bill O'Reilly was over the top, that it should have been kept to the issues. And that, frankly, when O'Reilly went after the CEO of JetBlue, I didn't think that was right. I think it's dumb of any, you know, any media guy who's supported by advertisers to go after advertisers, you know, regardless of whose they are. But at least it was on the issues, distorted issues, you know, lies about what was on the coast, but arguably on the issues rather than a personal attack. That's become quite a hot issue over on the coast, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, O'Reilly just needs constantly to replenish people and issues and organizations to target. And so this week he came up with daily costs. We should remember that Fox and O'Reilly last winter came up with this fictitious attack on Christmas. They just pull these things out of thin air. And also for O'Reilly to say that another organization is hateful is somewhat ironic considering the nature of his program and his constant attacks on people and telling people to shut up, as Robert Greenwald chronicled in Outfoxed. So it's somewhat interesting. I should report that Bill O'Reilly aside, the number one piece of apparel at Daily Kos is simply a sticker that says impeach. Fill in the blank, I guess. It doesn't have a name after it. Could be Bush, Cheney, Gonzalez, go down the list. But that's probably what most ties the over 2,000 attendees here together in Chicago.
That's interesting. I notice on the front page of BuzzFlash.com, Time Magazine must be reading BuzzFlash. It finally understands that Bush is keeping Gonzalez in office to protect him, Cheney, Rove, and others from criminal prosecution. It's the action of a mob leader, not a president. What's the story here?
It was quite amazing for us because most of the mainstream media has covered the whole Gonzalez issue as an issue of, well, when will he resign or when will he kind of throw in the towel, rather than the fact that Bush won't let him resign. I think Gonzalez probably fears more for his future if he does resign than if he stays in, given the pension of the Bush administration for retribution. What the Time story did was cut to the chase and said, look, the Bush administration, including Cheney, can't afford for Gonzalez to resign. This guy knows where all the skeletons are in the closet. If he resigns, they're going to end up, the Democrats will force in some sort of person who's has some modicum of integrity, which means that the Bush administration itself will probably be targeted for indictments, and certainly that would then very possibly lead to impeachment. But what we have here, and I mean, if you in reading the Time article, doesn't say it this explicitly, but the way it lays out why Gonzalez cannot leave or why the Bush administration cannot allow him to leave is basically that they have to obstruct justice in order to prevent themselves from being indicted. I mean, that's basically what the Time article indicates.
Go ahead.
It doesn't say it that way, but it says that the Bush administration knows that if Gonzalez leaves, they will be subject to criminal investigation.
Yeah, it's not so much that they're counting on Gonzalez to hide secrets that he knows, or that they're counting on him to remain quiet or anything like that, although he's done a good job of that. It's that they're counting on him to proactively prevent investigations and reactively stop investigations that are already underway.
Well, nothing could have been greater proof of this than, as you've discussed and we discussed last Friday on the program, that the Bush White House has forbidden the Department of Justice to pursue any congressional contempt citations through the U.S. prosecutor in Washington relating to executive privilege. In essence, they've upped the ante and basically committed obstruction of justice through that requirement of the Justice Department not to pursue contempt charges on executive privilege to, in and of itself, obstruct justice. They are saying that the Congress cannot pursue a possible criminal activity that might involve the White House, and that's only to protect them. That is obstruction of justice by prima facie.
On its face. Yeah, on its face. We're talking to Mark Carlin, the editor and publisher over at BuzzFlash.com. Mark, in violation of federal law, Ohio's 2004 presidential election records are now destroyed or missing. The logical reason, this is your headline at BuzzFlash.com, cover up for fraud in the 2004 stolen election. Tell us about this. We just have just about a half a minute here.
Well, I think that the Bush administration, we go back to 2000, we know the election was stolen, I mean, by a 5-4 decision of the court, before the all the votes could be counted, because Scalia said that it might impugn the reputation of the would-be winner, George Bush. In 2004, there are many different viewpoints about whether the election was stolen, but I think there's probably little doubt that the Republicans played fast and loose with some of the voting. And those votes are now in the process of evaporating, so we'll never be able to prove it.
Yeah, and all the more the tragedy. Mark Carlin, BuzzFlash.com. Mark, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. It's 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
Welcome back to our program, 6 minutes past the hour. Christy Harvey with us from the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. She's the Director of Strategic Communications, and she also creates the daily news prep site, MikeCheckRadio.org. Hey, Christy.
Hey, how are you?
Just great. Great to have you with us. Who is directing the non-strategic communications over there?
Those take care of themselves. It's the strategic stuff you got to watch out for.
There you go. Okay. Good answer. FDA bonus envy? Tell me about this story here. Top officials at the FDA up to something?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite stories I've seen recently. The FDA and many government agencies have a fund that they budget into called a bonus retention fund. And basically what this is money that they can offer to, say, a top scientist to remain working for the government instead of going into working for a private company where he'd make more money. So it's a way to keep your top scientists, biologists, and people like that from going into the private sector. So the FDA took this a step further. And they decided, the top officials at the FDA said, to heck with the scientists. We probably need this money to keep ourselves from going to the private sector. And so...
Oh, jeez. Are you talking political appointees here?
Political appointees, administration officials, the guys who run the offices, decided that they wanted to start paying themselves to not join lobbying firms in Washington. And spent, in 2005, they spent $13.6 million giving themselves bonuses to keep them from leaving the FDA.
Now, on the one, you know, what's so bizarre about this, Christy, on the one hand, this is the kind of story that causes people to buy into the right-wing talking point that government is corrupt and the only way to stop it is to prevent there from ever being any taxes collected anywhere by anybody, et cetera. And yet at the same time, I think so many Americans have forgotten that there was a time when government actually worked. It wasn't corrupt. That government salary was considered a good middle-class salary and people were willing to work for it. In a way, this is the consequence of the skewing of things since the 1980s, I would say as a result of doing away with the top minimum, you know, the top marginal tax rate and thus this explosion of wealth in the private sector and the Reagan ethos that government is bad, government does nothing good, and in fact... sorry about that. Wrong.
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Yeah, so, you know,
right.
this whole idea that, you know, government is bad. It's tragic that this is happening. And it's tragic that most people are going to view it in the context of a conservative frame, which is, even though it's conservatives doing it, which is, see, I told you government was bad.
let me help out a little with that. This actually used to work, and it wasn't until 2002, surprise, surprise, that they started to abuse the system. And they've actually quadrupled the amount of these retention bonuses that have gone out since 2002, and they've stopped giving them to the scientists and people like that. So it's not an issue of, I think, government, big government, small government. It's an issue of bad people out for themselves taking power in Washington. And we've unfortunately seen a heck of a lot of that since, you know, 2002.
Yeah.
I love it, though. Well, they started paying themselves more than Supreme Court justice members or members of Congress.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, if you don't believe in government and you find yourself in a position of power in government, but you really think that the highest value is to enrich yourself no matter where you are, and, you know, the kind of the corporate message of profits over all else, then it just makes sense that if you saw an opportunity to stick some money in your pocket and not go to jail doing it, you'd take the opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. And like you said, when you don't have sort of a driving passion to help people or to do a little good in the world, then you're especially going to get in a little bit of trouble when there isn't oversight and there's just a big pot of money sitting there saying, take me, take me. You know, unfortunately, people are going to take it.
I really think the solution to this is to go back to the frankly, I think, and this is a very unpopular thing, and you don't have to comment on this, but if you look at what happened from the mid-1930s until the mid-1980s, the main thing that was restraining explosions of greed and weird behavior on the high end of the income scale was the fact that the top marginal tax rate ran from 91% up until Jack Kennedy became president. And, you know, Kennedy dropped it down to 71% or 70%, but he closed up a whole mess of loopholes. I mean, he sold that as a tax increase, not a tax cut, because he said nobody in the 90% bracket is paying it. I know because I'm there. And so he said, we're going to actually make them pay 70%. And he tightened up all these loopholes and had a 70% bracket. But Reagan took that down to 29%. And at that point, then, hey, anybody can get as rich as they want because there's,
right,
you know, there's no ceiling there. It was, you hit that, and you didn't hit that top tax bracket until you had earned your first $3.2 million. That's when it kicked in, that 91% or 70% bracket. In today's dollars, it was $3.2 million. It did, and then on your $3.2 million and first dollar, you started paying that amount. And so, you know, there wasn't that bizarre distortion in the marketplace, frankly, in my opinion.
No, that's anyway. Bold statement there. I kind of like it. I also think that this is a big oversight kind of thing. I mean, there's a definite reason that people like Dick Cheney and people in the FDA want to keep everything so secret and hush hush and this is none of your business. Look away, trust us, we're fine. And I think that's why it's so important to never trust anybody and just keep really big on oversight, open government, sunshine, and Freedom of Information Act laws.
Yeah, and
I like to crack down the bad guys.
Yeah, and to say, you know, if you're making $3.2 million a year, you're doing fine. Thank you very much.
Right.
190,000, the magic number. What is the significance of this?
Scary, scary stuff. The GAO just decided to say, you know what? We've spent $2.8 billion on the Iraq security forces. Let's just go, I don't know, check in and see how things are going. And they found out that since 2004, we can't account for 190,000 guns that we gave to Iraqi security forces. They're just gone. Poof. Nobody knows where they are. Nobody can track them. Nobody thought to write down serial numbers and see where they ended up. And unfortunately, we know where a lot of them have ended up, and that's with the insurgents. But it just goes to show you that there is a big price to pay for just sort of being sloppy over in Iraq, as we were for especially the first couple of years of the war.
190,000 is probably in the neighborhood of the number of people who have been trained to be Iraqi army and Iraqi police and then just vanished, too. And
well,
as
right.
you said, become insurgents or become members of sectarian militias.
But at least the GAO is keeping an eye on it.
Yeah. Well, they'll tell us about it. But, I mean, the administration's doing nothing about it. And, by the way, is anything being done about these guys at the FDA giving themselves these retention bonuses, or is this just going to continue?
I think at this point it's just going to continue. But I'm hoping now that it's out, it made the Washington Post this morning, that my favorite mustache of justice, Sir Henry Waxman, will do a little
Indeed.
Of his oversight magic on it. But we'll see. At this point, nobody's announced that they're doing any sort of cleanup over at the FDA yet.
Yeah, he's kind of this generation's William Proxmire. Don Young of Alaska, the Republican representative, the sole member of the House of Representatives representing the great state of Alaska, has threatened to bite another representative on the floor of the House.
It was a really, really weird day yesterday. Yeah, Don Young from Alaska, of course, was on the floor of the House. And, you know, I love watching, for example, British Parliament, where everybody screams and yells and pounds on the table. But yeah, they usually, even when they're being nasty, keep some sort of decorum in the House of Representatives here. And this week, Don Young was very upset about an appropriations thing that was going to shift money from some schools in Alaska to some schools in New Jersey. And so he stood up on the floor and started to rant, and at one point started to say that, you know, people in Congress aren't afraid to sometimes bite each other, and he feels like he's being bit now, but never you mind, because one day he'll come back and bite you back, and maybe it'll kill you. And everyone went,
whoa,
what? What did he just say?
Well, you have
so
all three.
He needs a timeout.
Yeah, you have all three Republicans. I mean, you know, in the congressional delegation from Alaska, under investigation in various ways for corruption, you can guess that they'd be pretty stressed out.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think that they're really stressed out at this point. You know, but at least he did take a break from being raided or investigated or whatever's going on to show up at the House. But,
yeah,
oh, our jaws dropped yesterday. Very, very infrequently is C-SPAN that interesting.
Just amazing. Christy Harvey, the Center for American Progress, the Director of Strategic Communications, AmericanProgress.org, the website, and MikeCheckRadio.org. Christy, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Great talking to you. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Taking my country back. Boys, you ain't been doing it right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you botched Iraq. So I'm taking my country back.
And we can't wait until the elections of 2008. We need to be participating right now and taking our country back. And how do we do that? You get out and get there, get involved in the political process. Get involved in what's going on. That's the really the only solution to all of this. Here we have, it's interesting, Harry Reid today on the floor of the Senate talking about how the infrastructure of this country is crumbling, and it's time to start paying attention to it. This is from CNN, talking about how, here's the quote from Harry Reid. He said, "We have all over this country crumbling infrastructure, highways, bridges, dams, and we really need to take a hard look at this." He also pointed out that repairing infrastructure is good for America. He said, "For every $1 billion we spend in our crumbling infrastructure, 47,000 high-paying jobs are created," which is the point that I was making earlier in my whole riff about how, you know, if we should be spending money to rebuild New Orleans in New Orleans rather than bringing in foreign corporations or soon-to-be foreign corporations like Halliburton and you know, sending the money off to what ultimately is going to be Dubai or the United Arab Emirates. And meanwhile, at the same time, the Heartland Institute and the Taxpayers League of Minnesota issuing a news release under Phil Krinke, the president of the Taxpayer League of Minnesota, issuing a news release congratulating the governor of Minnesota, the Republican Tim Pawlenty, for vetoing a transportation bill, a $5 billion transportation bill in the state of Minnesota that much of which would have matched federal funds for upgrading roads and bridges and things like that. Yeah. Another story in the news, by the way. This just to shift topics somewhat, but I think this is something that's really worth paying attention to. In the Financial Times, which I'm reading more and more as I'm beginning my I'm preparing to cancel my subscription to the Wall Street Journal. It's, man, Rupert Murdoch. In any case, here from the Financial Times today, Richard McGregor in Beijing and Owen Callan in Washington. Beijing would bring forward its commitment to allow new foreign joint venture brokerages to enter the local market this year. Now, you know, what does this mean? Or what is this about? Well, Hank Paulson, who has, you know, was formerly the head of Goldman Sachs, the investment house. He'd been there since 1974 and became its CEO after John Corzine, now the governor of New Jersey, left to go into politics. So Goldman Sachs seems to be providing us with all these people for the political agenda. And in any case, Henry Paulson goes over to China and says, you guys are protecting your brokerage industry, your Goldman Sachs type industry. You won't let American companies come over here to China, I mean, and buy into your brokerage industry. I mean, in America, not only can Chinese come over and buy into our brokerage firms or buy our brokerage firms, some of our brokerage firms are owned by people in or entities in England or in Saudi Arabia. In fact, the New York Stock Exchange itself has been put up for sale to foreign investors. So why don't you guys in China do that? And they said, as they have been saying for years and years and years about pretty much everything, which is one of the reasons why their economy has been growing stronger and stronger, they said, no. China's brokerage firms have to be Chinese. We don't want a bunch of Americans coming over here and selling securities to Chinese citizens. And he said, well, how about joint ventures then? Will you let us just, like, own a little piece of them? And they said, well, you know, we'll talk about that, which, of course, in Chinese diplomatic speak means not on your life. But he's still claiming this as a semi-victory. He said, and this is the quote from Mr. Paulson, our Secretary of the Treasury. He said, for the life of me, I cannot understand why China, letting in strong foreign firms, which are regulated by the Chinese, would undermine stability. It would help stability. So here we have our Secretary of the Treasury buying into this line that has been peddled to us ever since Reagan became president, that it's good for America to sell off America, and equally it would be good for China to sell off China. Whatever happened to the idea of sovereignty? The article goes on to note, Mr. Paulson said he'd been told by Shang Fulin, the head of Chinese Securities Regulatory Commission, that the moratorium on new brokerages joint ventures would be lifted in the northern autumn, a few months ahead of the initial schedule. Many banks are talking to potential partners in China in readiness to do deals to enter a sector that now has few foreign participants. So, you know, maybe they're going to let a few people buy a little bit of some of their brokerage firms. I'm telling you, the Chinese are not stupid. All we have to do is look at what's happening in India, where Walmart is being kept out of India aggressively. 97% of the retail sector in India is owned by small local businesses. By law. Look at what they're doing in India and China and figure out how we can do it here. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
There's room enough here.
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Jeff Rook is with us. Is it pronounced Rook, Jeff?
It is.
Thank you. Pure.org, the website, R-U-C-H, the way your name is spelled. You're the executive director of Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility.
Which is mercifully acronymed as PEER.
Right, and Pure.org, the website, thus. And, Jeff, back in 2002, we had a senator from Oregon, oddly enough, although this is really a national story, not a regional story. We had a senator from Oregon who was among many Republican senators up for election or reelection that the White House, specifically Karl Rove, apparently decided that they were going to help out by messing with science and reality. And it was Gordon Smith, and the deal was to divert water out of the Klamath River and give it to farmers, and the farmers, in turn, presumably would give political support and financial contributions and whatnot to Senator Smith, which they did, and he got reelected. But there's been some fallout from this in the years since.
Well, it's now 2007, and Congress, nearly 5 years later, is finally taking its first look.
I should probably add, I guess that people realize what I do because I live here in the Pacific Northwest, that what this led to was the biggest salmon kill in the history, as far as I could tell, in the history of the United States, certainly in the history of the Pacific Northwest. And we had fishermen who were just being wiped out. I mean, the governor had to declare a state of emergency. They were coming up with state funds to help these fishing families, you know, small family-owned businesses that made a living fishing for salmon in the Pacific Northwest, in the Columbia River, and along the Pacific Ocean. It wiped them out.
Well, and as you may recall, in 2001, there was a very big controversy about the federal government denying water deliveries to the farms. And so in 2002, at the time of the controversy, the White House was determined and had set up what was a very big photo opportunity in April to open the sluice gates and let the water flow out of the river to the irrigators. And in essence, nothing was going to stop that photo op. And what we heard testimony about in one of our clients, who was the lead biologist for the National Marine Fisheries Service, was told that basically they should take the estimates of the minimum amount of flow that was needed in the river and cut it in half. And that decision to cut it in half was made without any kind of analysis. He described it as a biological opinion without a biologist, or being told to find that 1 + 1 = 3.
Now, this is Michael Kelly, NMFF's National Marine Fisheries Service biologist, who led the Klamath technical team until he quit in disgust, right?
Yes, and it actually wasn't over Klamath. He asked to be reassigned because he didn't think he could look at himself in the mirror and continue. And then he found that the same dynamic was going on in other projects. And when he realized that he was just going to be running against the same brick wall where outside interests would be able to come in and dictate what the scientific findings were, he decided he should go elsewhere.
Right. So this was not just limited to the Klamath River in Oregon and or the Pacific Northwest. This is something that is just emblematic. I mean, this is a really good symbol. And what's really ironic is that I'm not sure what part of the country you're living in, but I believe you're in Washington, D.C.
Lovely Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I can tell you, out here near Washington State and Oregon, Senator Smith is now claiming that he's going to solve the problem of the dead salmon, issuing statements about, he's on it. He's going to fix this problem.
Well,
Representative
Smith, also from Oregon, was among a number of Republicans who came to the committee hearing to say that Congress shouldn't look into it because it might interfere with the deal that is now taking shape on the Klamath, which was interesting because the idea that congressional oversight would upset that kind of arrangement suggested that it was a fairly shaky deal.
Yeah, you mean Congressman Graham? The guy who gave this order to Mr. Kelly to cut the water in half and give the water to the fishermen, kill off the fish, it's going to help Gordon Smith, it's going to help a Republican senator, and therefore, to hell with the fish. This guy, James Leckie,
he was
who
promoted.
Was he? And what happened to him?
He was promoted, and he's now in charge of all endangered species management for the National Marine Fisheries Service. He's not only been promoted, but he's been given performance awards and other sorts of honors for handling difficult assignments. And one of the points that kind of got lost in this hearing, because one of the backdrops was the role that Vice President Dick Cheney played, but one of the main points was that this politicizing of science goes beyond the Department of Interior and extends into other agencies. And in this case, the National Marine Fisheries Service is located as part of NOAA inside the Department of Commerce. And the Department of Commerce was also getting those Karl Rove briefings. What was interesting about the earlier investigations is they were actually investigating the wrong department, because the Department of Interior, while it played a role, it wasn't doing the science. It was actually the applicant. The Bureau of Reclamation, an arm of Interior, was the one that was, in essence, fronting for the irrigators. And the pressure was on the NOAA and NIMS people to basically remove any scientific objections they had on behalf of threatened and endangered fish who, as it turns out, once the water was cut off, died in record numbers.
Died. Yeah. And NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration?
Yes.
I think most of us think of NOAA as the agency that is responsible for telling us if hurricanes are coming or global warming is real. You're saying that that's the agency that is the Uber agency over the National Marine Fisheries Service
that was
politicized in this case to help this Republican Senate.
And they're under tremendous amount of pressure, not only from development or irrigator interests, but one of the other places they get a heck of a lot of blowback from is the Navy. So the NIMS, NOAA people are right on the front line of issues like these new Navy radar or sonar arrays that are linked to blowing out the acoustical systems of mammals and other issues such as that.
Blowing out the ears, for lack of a better word, of whales and things.
And humans, if humans happen to be in the water at the time.
Right, and this is one of the reasons why these large marine mammals are beaching themselves, is because they're totally disoriented. They don't have the ability to use
sound. And the scientists that are supposed to be exercising the independent check on the Navy's plans are under extreme pressure, and they've not gotten any support from their chain of command, and that agency, NOAA, has basically turned itself into a pretzel to get out of the way of what the Navy wants to do.
We're talking with Jeff Rook. He is the Executive Director of Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, P-E-E-R, peer.org is their website. And you guys were looking into the situation with the fish kill in the Pacific Northwest, and Director of the National Marine Fisheries Service, William Hogarth, was asked about this politicization of his agency and political interference. What was his response?
Well, his response that it wasn't a problem and that anyone, including his own scientists that said so, didn't understand what was going on. And he said that in response to a survey that we had done in partnership with a union of concerned scientists, where we sent out a survey to all of, I think it was 1,500 NIMS scientists, every scientist in every field office and laboratory across the country. More than a third of them responded, and what those respondents said was fairly chilling. More than half had experience where political appointees or outside interests had come in and dictated a result contrary to the evidence, and more than a third had experience being told to remove technical findings for non-scientific reasons. He reacted to that survey by saying, well, you didn't talk to everybody, and that many things go into these decisions, and they just don't understand what goes on. Since that time, there have been a number of other revelations concerning what's going on in that agency that call into question Dr. Hogarth's leadership.
Yeah, to say the very least. Jeff, I think a lot of Americans think that the anti-science bias of this administration is just some quaint affect of the fundamentalist Christianity that seems to run through at least what is said to be the fundamentalist Christianity. I would suggest that these guys are anti-Christian in their behavior, but nonetheless, that they're putting forward, and that it's pretty much limited to things like creationism, denying evolution and denying that there's global warming. What it seems that you're suggesting with this study and numerous other areas is that the anti-science bias really has a almost entirely political basis to it. that it's all about power and money.
It's mainly about money. Campaign contributors can call the White House, and the White House can directly dictate results on matters big and small. It's one of the reasons that Karl Rove and his deputies run around and do these briefings, is they are explaining to the agency heads, who are themselves political appointees, who are our friends and who are the people we don't care about. And a lot of the cases that we deal with on the environmental side, the vast majority of them, are because of economic interests who are campaign contributors, who are able to dictate or reverse what the scientists inside the agencies are saying. The silver lining out of all this is that I think it's finally becoming clear to many in, on both sides of the aisle in Congress, that there's a problem here. And that the way this is enforced is that the administration has been quite efficient in what they call message management. And that means that discordant scientific results are squelched or rewritten.
Right.
You hear this from...
Jeff, we're out of time. I appreciate it. Jeff wrote Pura.org for more information. It's great having you on.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
For crimes and lies, you'd like to see him kicked out on his push. Friends, you've got good reason. I support you absolutely. But this impeachment season, don't forget your civic duty. Impeach Cheney first. It can still get worse. After Bushes and Cubs, it's liable to get rough. Impeach Cheney first.
That sounds like a reasonable plan.
Cheney first.
Yeah, Dennis Kucinich is on it. Get people to sign on to that. What is it, House Resolution 333, as I recall? 9.5 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Hey, Ellen.
Well, hi. The president took aim at the Congress today. On spending, and then he goes after them for the fact that they haven't finished their budgets. Well, just remind everybody that the Republicans didn't finish their budgets till after the elections because they couldn't get it together, and they had the House, the Senate, and the White House. So that's one thing. The other thing he did is he goes after them for spending $22 billion in discretionary spending next year. Well, if you recall, much of that was for Katrina and for further armaments for our troops in Iraq that the Democrats added to the president's budget.
Right, but he doesn't like that.
He'll take credit
for it in the photo op, but he doesn't like it when he can just call it spending.
Well, he said that's $1,300 in higher spending every second of every minute of every hour of every day of every year for the next 5 years. Well, that's fine, and I'm glad somebody did the math for him, but the point is a lot of that was for necessary spending that he had not prioritized.
Do you think that could be in response to one of the Democratic groups yesterday or the day before pointed out that we're spending $2,000, was it $2,000 a second? No, maybe it was $200,000 a second in Iraq. I mean, it was just some blinding amount of money.
I'm sure they just took that and said, well, what a good idea. Let's turn it against them.
Right.
Also, today, it was actually Henry Waxman and Tom Davis, the ranking minority committee, sent a letter, to the White House. And this has to do with Pat Tillman's death by friendly fire. And they said that they agreed to have informal interviews with Bartlett, McClellan, and Gerson, who used to be the president's speechwriter. And, of course, McClellan used to be the press person. And then, however, they said that if they do have relevant information. We're going to ask them to return to the committee for a transcribed proceeding so the committee has an official record of their statement. And then they said, we hope that at that point you would refrain from asserting any claims of privilege. And then they said that they also had asked for drafts of the president's speech to the White House Correspondents' Dinner in May 2001, the drafts of the president's speech, and they said that essentially they understand that executive privilege could be made and that they're not asking for that, but they're asking that other drafts are available for staff review by August 10th. Now, remember,
this is the speech in which Bush referred to Pat Tillman, right?
That's right, yeah. At the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And that all happened, on May 1st in 2004. But essentially, this is also signed. What's important about this is it just didn't come from Henry Waxman. It also came from Tom Davis, who's the ranking minority member.
Right. The Republican from Virginia, Tom Davis.
Exactly.
So here we have a Republican, Tom Davis, on that committee. And you have the Republican Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania, who is raising questions. You've got Republicans there's been a variety of them, who are, you know, Susan Collins and whatnot, who are saying, hey, wait a minute, let's stop this war. I mean, there is not Republican unanimity, it seems, in almost anything, and yet the White House continues to spin all dissent as being partisan and Democratic.
Right. Exactly. And what you're seeing is that the Republicans are coming along with the Democrats on several issues. Now, there's one other thing. The president promised some help, federal help, in terms of the Mississippi bridge collapse. The First Lady is going out there. And it turns out that 13% of the United States bridges are structurally deficient. As you recall, about five, six years ago, there was a report out that to fix America's school would need about $6 billion. And that doesn't even deal with all the huge infrastructure problems that we have in the United States that we have paid no attention to.
Right. And at the same time, the Taxpayers League of Minnesota, the chairman or the president of the Taxpayers League, Phil Krinkle, issued a press release yesterday over the Heartland Institute's letterhead, about 2 hours before the bridge collapsed, congratulating the Republican governor of Minnesota, Tim Pawlenty, for vetoing, quote, to block a transportation bill containing more than $5 billion, and also vetoing an entire $334 million emergency capital investment fund. So the
Mr. Pawlenty's not going to look so good, particularly as he hosts the Republican convention next summer.
Yeah. Oh boy.
Remember that's happening in Minneapolis.
Oh man. And what a
notwithstanding.
Yeah. I mean, this has got to be a really tough one for the citizens of Minneapolis too. It's we're on the air in Minneapolis, and my heart goes out to them. It's just
it's terrible.
A tough time.
It's terrible.
But so all across the United States, we have people who are suffering the consequences. Whether realized or unrealized, and apparently this was at some level realized, but of the disastrous lack of infrastructure maintenance, so and the consequences of right wing ideology that's leading to it. Real quickly, I guess we've got to wrap it up here. Ellen Ratner, the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Good talking with you today. Coming up tomorrow, Anything Goes Friday. Assuming our phones are working, Senator Bernie Sanders will be with us taking your calls, as he does every Friday, plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your radio support group for We the People. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there and participate. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at Air America Radio.